For me,
it's Ian's turn, Sean.
Oh fuck, man! Nobody's talking, so I figured I'd
go ahead, Sean.
I've got a script. No, it's gonna throw the script off.
I couldn't read your script that you weren't articulating out loud. That's on your desk,
Sean. Don't get mad. He does this all the time.
Wow,
there's Hot Hillman. Here he comes.
Hot takes Hillman.
Who had 9 minutes on their bingo card for me going off the rails?
Hello, I'm David.
I'm Lewis.
I'm Sean Hillman.
And I'm Ian Rice.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we discuss and review a rock record of our choice. On today's episode, we will be discussing the 1993 album from Seattle-based band Pearl Jam, Versus. Lou, what's your story with this record?
Well, I got a long story with Pearl Jam. They were the first band that I sent a postcard to when I got 10, and they sent me a 45 and a bunch of stickers. I've been in that fan club since then. Well, actually since 96, when I actually paid some dues. And then I was a diehard member up until this year. And that's where the fan club used to be a great way to sidestep the painful Ticketmaster process. It's not that anymore. And it's not really worth being a member, in my opinion, any longer. But when Versus came out, we were waiting with bated breath for the new Pearl Jam. We were expecting a record called Five Against One and had heard a couple of tunes on MTV Singles, MTV Singles movie premiere. There was a special and a few like bootleg live tapes, but nothing really prepared me for what they laid down on this release. And that's where I'm coming in, right on release day.
Much like the rest of the nation that was into rock at the time, I was waiting for this record to come out, and there was a lot of excitement around Pearl Jam's sophomore album, what it was going to be like. And, I can distinctly remember just like a fever pitch around this record. And it was very, very different than 10. I will say that. And even as I was a kid at the time, and it was not what I was expecting, but yet I wasn't disappointed. And, you know, I've been proud to say I've been with Pearl Jam from the ground floor, and Verse still sticks out even all these years later as a real highlight in their catalog for me.
Yeah, I was a big fan of 10. It hit me in my early to mid teenage years right at the right time. And I'm easily influenced, so that didn't hurt. Loved it and loved what we were hearing was coming down the pipeline. I wasn't in the fan club. I wasn't that into it or didn't have the means to. I had spent all my money with Columbia House on the 8-for-1 specials, but I really enjoyed their opening effort with 10. I was excited for Versus. So I was there on release day and ponied right up.
I'm one of those few Pearl Jam fans that does not have 10, like in my top three. I don't think it's a bad album, but it just didn't do a whole lot for me at the time. Now, I was telling Lou beforehand, the Brendan O'Brien mix definitely kicks it up a notch for me, but it was Alice in Chains when they came out is what really got me into this kind of music. In particular, that song, What the Hell Have I, off the Last Action Hero soundtrack, and then I got addicted to Alice in Chains. I'm not going to lie, Dirt, I played it for the rest of the time I was in high school, but I was excited about the Pearl Jam album. If for anything, it was just a big cultural moment because I'm not comparing them, quote unquote, to the Beatles, but that was a movement equivalent to our generation, to the Beatles. And I'll say this, you know, you had the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. For me, Pearl Jam and Neil Young on the MTV Awards is, I talked with Jason Carapesi the other day from State of Love and Trust Pod. And I think that is like possibly a top two or three defining musical moment for me. That them doing Animal and them doing the Five Against One thing, it just blew my mind. Dave Abruzzese beat the drums like they owed him money. And I'll go ahead and say it. In my opinion, he's the MVP of this record. And what he did on Rocking in the Free World, I still to this day do not know how the drums stayed upright. And I personally think it's a shame that he's no longer with the band, but I was excited for this to come out. It's weird how we remember different things. My grandfather died the day that this thing came out, and I remember giving money to my friend Kimberly. Can you go get the album for me? And the next day at school, she brought me the CD, and I think I had it on cassette too. So it's one of my favorite Pearl Jam albums, and I'm really excited we get to do this one. So now I'll give you the basic facts about this album. And this time they did not come from Wikipedia, Lou. Do you know where they came from? Snopes.com.
Wow, we're breaking tradition here.
Yeah. I had to go to Snopes on this. All right. So the album was released on October 19th, 1993. It was produced by Brendan O'Brien. If you're a Black Crowes fan, he engineered the first two Black Crowes albums. It reached number one on the charts, selling 950,000 copies in the first week, setting the record of the SoundScan era. It was number one for 7 weeks and has sold more than 7 million copies in America. So it's certified 7 times in America. All right. The primary players on the album: Eddie Vedder, lead vocals, rhythm guitar on Rearview Mirror, an elderly woman behind the counter in a small town. Mike McCready, lead guitar, Stone Gossard, rhythm guitar, backing vocals. Jeff Ament, bass, upright bass, credited as Ames or Ames. I'm not how he's going to go about for the artwork and black and white photography. Dave Abruzzese on drums, all lyrics by Eddie Vedder, and the music is written by Pearl Jam. All right, song number one was the lead single. This is Go.
All I could say is this was the farthest thing from what I expected when I threw this in my car on the way home from the midnight release party at the CD broker where I bought this. This was way more raw and aggressive than the first. If you think about 10 being the nice shiny Corvette from Boogie Nights that Marky Mark was driving, this was a few years later, haggard from the industry, trolling for coke in a bad neighborhood vet with one light stuck open and scratches on the door and cracks in the fiberglass and exhaust leak. You could tell there's a different driver here, too. Dave Abruzzese. Now, Dave Cruzan, he's no slouch. He wound up landing in Candlebox, I think. But you could tell that. Listen to some of the fills in Jeremy and Alive, but just Dave A crushes them. Jeff's bass growls like an angry bulldog prowling a junkyard, and Ed sounds crazed, angry. This is the beginning of Ed's angry phase. Hanging from the rafters, crowd riding Ed, punk rock Ed. Stone noodles in the background as Mike screams like a jilted girlfriend walking in on her longtime boyfriend and her little sister. I mean, holy shit, what a ride. Great opener. I mean, what the fuck is happening?
To me, this record is the start of the actual Pearl Jam sound. Like, the production on 10 is very glossy. It's very, you know, looking back 30 years on, it's a little more dated of a production style. This is that more live in the room kind of feel to it, evidenced by the kind of false start studio chatter kind of beginning to Go, and then it just pounds on in and it kind of introduces them and the album. This is a band that ain't fucking around. And I particularly love in this song where the lyrics slightly change from "don't go on me" to "don't you want me." I always liked that. It was just a subtle little flip for a second there. Really cool. And as Lou already mentioned, you know, Dave Abruzzese the total star of this record, and he is on fire here. Actually wrote the song, or at least came up with the original riff on an acoustic guitar, which I think is really cool. It's a hell of a guitar part for a drummer to come up with. And the thunder that comes out of his snare drum at the very end to close out the song is unbelievable. And, you know, I mirror Lou's sentiment. Just what an opener.
You talk about that snare drum. I'm surprised he didn't have to replace the head on it in that recording, because he beats the living tar out of that thing the whole time. All right. So it's October of 93. I'm 16. I don't have a car of my own yet. So I load up in the family's Ford Econoline full-size van.
Family Sportster.
That's right. Pimpin'. You know, the kind with two gas tanks, curtains on the inside of the windows, and the ladder spare tire combo on the back door. That thing was a beast. And oddly enough, a fitting place to play this record. After completing my purchase at Record Revolution in DeKalb, I popped the CD in the van to see what the rest of the album was going to be about. As the drums blasted in the van speakers and set those curtains rattling, I knew we had another banger. The Pearl Jam, to me, hit at the right time, and this album was a perfect follow-up to their opener, 10, and what a hell of a way to open the record itself.
All right, so this song to me starts off very kind of disjointed at the beginning, almost like a false start, like Midnight from the Inside Out from the Black Crowes lines, which I really like that kind of stuff. And it's interesting, you got the follow-up to one of the biggest albums of the last 20 years, and you're going to start it off sounding like the band may or may not know what they're doing when the song starts, which I think is pretty cool. I did some reaching out to, I'm going to reference Jason Carapesi from the State of Love and Trust pod. They're friends of ours. If you're a Pearl Jam fan, you need to go listen to them. It's the best Pearl Jam podcast, I believe, that there is. And there's a lot of rumors about what the song is actually about. So I reached out to him, and he was looking at some of the lyrics, and he thinks it could be possibly domestic violence or abuse. But then the rumor is it's about Eddie Vedder's truck breaking down. If you go read the lyrics now and have that in your mind, You can come to that conclusion. And it's never been denied by the band. So I have trouble a lot of times with Vedder's lyrics. First of all, I have trouble sometimes understanding them. I have to go read the liner notes. But then some of his lyrics are pretty vague. But I don't remember this being the lead single. For some reason, I thought Animal was the lead single. Do you guys remember this being the lead single? I don't remember that.
I don't think Go was the lead single, no.
No, I thought Animal was. That's the first one I saw on that special. Yeah,
me too.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here and go to Wikipedia instead. That's what I get for going to Snopes. All right. It Go is a song by American rock band Pearl Jam, released October 1993. It's the first single from the band's second album, Versus.
If only there was a way to edit Wikipedia.
All right. Song number two is Animal.
From Go right into another up-tempo, another anthemic song. The Five Against One would be a kind of a band mantra for quite some time afterwards. I always like that. It's kind of like us against the world, you know, and that's where Pearl Jam was at this time. They were ready to conquer, and conquer they did. I always liked the little funk guitar strumming kind of behind when he's singing I'd Rather Be With an Animal. Just a little touch in there that I always liked. You know, Dave Abruzzese is an animal here. No pun intended. You know how I feel about puns. And a fantastic guitar solo. before the band kind of abandoned the guitar solo for a period of time. It became kind of passe for Pearl Jam to have guitar solos, but there's a real great one on this. I always love this song.
The senior senator from Illinois, you have the floor.
Well, we don't stop after Go. We rip right into Animal. Combining some anti-record company executive and bigwig targeted anger with Stone Gossard's music, Animal lifts a big middle finger to the man, even after he backed you in a corner. That's right. If you're going to go down, at least do it with your principles intact. At about 3 minutes, the song makes a point and leaves you thinking, okay, don't fuck with these guys, which I think was the goal. The album is 2 for 2 so far in my book.
Yeah, this is the song they did on that show on MTV. After I heard this, I couldn't wait to get my hands on this record. It took forever. You're right. It was a fever pitch. It's got a classic Stone groove. Ament and Gossard just create this groove that's so fluid to make a 1% outlaw biker shake his ass. Again, Ed's pissed as a rattlesnake. He'd rather be with an animal. Me too, dude. Lay off the Red Bull, though. They're set up the opposite in the soundstage than they are live. Facing the speaker, Stone's on the right and Mike's on the left. They've got a distinct chug pattern for the groove, and Mike lets it fly on the right. He's moved past Stevie Ray's clone here, and he's developed this furious rapid-fire style that just makes you hang on for dear life. Another one that's full throttle from front to back. Wow, what a 1-2 punch.
All right, this is a top probably 5 Pearl Jam song for me. As we said earlier, the title of the album for months had been speculated it was going to be 5 Against 1. To me, the song has a unique cadence where the guitars drop out for a quick second on either side, kind of like Lou was talking about. Song is full of anger. It's debatable what it's about. I've read that the record company wanted the vocals turned up so he could know what the song is about, and Vedder told him the subject, and the executive agreed and said, let's turn the vocals back down. Dave A, that's what I'm calling from here on out. He shines on this song. He's driving the train, man. The way he hits the hi-hat, and with it, I'm not a drummer, but it sounds looser, and just the sound of his snare drum is kind of the sound of this album for me. This album is full of rage, and this is one of the angrier songs in the catalog. And you read about how Vedder couldn't handle the success, and you know, there's all this pressure to write a follow-up, and I'm sure there's pressure from the record company, like, we need Alive Again and Even Flow, Jeremy and Black. And you know, supposedly he was just completely uncomfortable writing the lyrics, to the point he even, like, I think he even, like, slept in his truck for a while trying to get uncomfortable. And this is one of the songs that that came out, I don't know, it's a band in their prime that just clicking on all cylinders right now, and this song's a prime example of it. It's a perfect example of melody, anger, and playing all at the same time in a way that very few bands can do. And so, like I said, it's one of my favorite Pearl Jam songs of all time. All right, song number 3, Daughter.
Table in an otherwise
Jeremy Part 2. This band can tell a riveting story. Just like Jeremy, the song owns the airwaves. I think it's amusingly ironic the subject matter are abusive parents with a differently abled child. Not because the subject matter itself, but because of the resounding success of the song. Where else but music and movies will we sing along and celebrate such tragic topics with wild vigor and enthusiasm? She holds the hand that holds her down. I believe there's a special room in hell for those that abuse animals and children. Maybe that's why this song gets to me so much. So let's talk about the music itself. Opening with a double stroke hi-hat rhythm, I learned the studio version of this actually strips down the drums more than what Dave A. originally had intended. The drums are minimal, but they end up being perfect for the song. The guitar takes lead at about a minute 48 with a solo to match Eddie's lyric. Tasteful, but it makes its point. The fade out on acoustic guitar at the end is icing on the cake. This is like a heavy coat. It's great to put on and feels good to take off. In my humble opinion, one of Pearl Jam's greatest compositions ever.
You can hear Stone say, "You guys ready?" if you crank it at the beginning of the track. After the sonic assault of the first two songs, here's a way to catch your breath, even for a second. Heavy subject matter combined with a country fried down home electrified campfire sing along. Definitely not what we were hearing at the time. A sense of dread and apprehension lay like a blanket over this tune. And you're right, Dave A carries this with class and doesn't overplay at all, I don't think, while adding little accents. And holy shit, did you hear that kind of hi-hat stickery? The guy's just amazing. I like what the band does with this live. They usually add like a tag to the end of the, it with a section of like a cover song or something or another one of theirs. But it always has a magical feeling when they dust it off now. Great tune. Another great tune.
The acoustic guitar on this, and this is a big sticking point for me with a lot of records, the acoustic guitar is recorded perfectly on this. And I always admire a producer or an engineer that can record an acoustic perfectly. And that acoustic paired with Dave Abruzzese's playing, which is above even his top-notch standard on this track. Just the two of those things together on this is great. Dave has a real knack for like hi-hat fills. It's very subtle things. You have to listen very closely. That's why I like his version of Even Flow, the re-recorded version that he plays on, because he's throwing so much more stuff into it. And he's just such a technically proficient player. And this song has a very cool dynamic build to it where it starts very quietly and it works its way up to a louder volume. And I always like a band that can straddle dynamics that way. And Pearl Jam is really good at that. And even with a subject matter as serious as this one, Eddie Vedder still knows how to incorporate a hook in there and make it a song that's unforgettable. And this is one of the top songs in their entire catalog for me.
I love the acoustic guitar strumming at the beginning, how it's kind of set in the background and it's not quite as bright as you would hear on other songs. If I remember correctly, in concert, that's Stone playing that. And I love his style on stage, the way he holds the guitar and just kind of strums effortlessly. This is a classic Eddie Vedder singing about something very demented but yet giving it kind of a cool radio friendly course, kind of like Alive. That's a depressing song. This is even more depressing. Physical abuse of a woman or a girl that has a learning disability. I mean, are you kidding me? You got to wonder where some of this comes from, though, in his head. But this one, I like the few times I've seen it, like full concerts of theirs. I think specifically like the live in New York City, they'll really drag that ending out at times, which is cool. And sometimes put another song. I think they, Lou, don't they do Indifferent sometimes with paired with this? Like they go into it
sometimes.
Yeah. So,
I mean, it's not like a regular thing. They've probably done it, you know, once or twice.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a song that like you hear people, the commoner, the non Pearl Jam fan, hear it on the radio and they're singing it. And I don't think people pay attention to the lyrics a lot of times. This is not something to be, it's not a jubilant song, but one of the more memorable ones from the album. I mean, the lay people of the world definitely know what this song is. All right. The next song is Glorified G.
Here's the example of the insufferable prick Eddie Vedder can be if he doesn't agree with whatever politics or belief you have. The guy was pissed off that you mentioned it before. The guy was pissed off that the studio that they recorded this record in was too nice and he was too comfortable to make a rock album. I mean, come on. Give me a fucking break, Ed. I love your band, but it's really hard to look over you being such an insufferable douchebag. Among the likes of some of the great insufferable douchebags of our lifetime. I mean, there's Bono, the Sting, Morrissey, and now you. How'd that Ticketmaster thing work out? Oh, by the way, nice watch. Well, here we have him poking at Dave A's interest in firearms as a hobby. Without getting all high and mighty and pissing off a few of our listeners, let's just say that if Ed ain't happy, nobody's happy. And I wasn't ever a fan of the song, even before I read the lyrics. So it's definitely
Blues obligatory skipper on every record.
I'm somewhat in agreement with Lou. I think that musically this song is very cool. The lyrically, I don't mind, you know, however you sit with gun control and your thoughts on that, it really, you know, makes no difference. The lyrics are, they're just kind of goofy. Like they're too silly to make it a song that really sticks with you after listening to it, and especially in the wake of the first three songs on the record. This song's kind of a Passover.
That's like half of the problem I have with it as well, is it's just at least write good lyrics for it. If you're going to be, you know, if you're going to take that shape, don't just make it a taunting, you know, playground song.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's exactly what I think about it. I do kind of like the one little sarcastic line he throws in there, the way he says it, kindred to being an American. I just always thought that was funny. But other than that, it's kind of a throwaway for me.
Well, we had Lou, then we had Switzerland. Now I'll give you the crossfire the other side.
Who's Switzerland? Me?
Yeah, you.
Oh, yeah, I like to be diplomatic. You know what I mean?
He's always
Everybody
Switzerland.
Likes you for a reason. So
because I'm handsome. Oh, that's not it?
Good thing. The Switzerland thing. A statement on our firearm-loving, blood-spilling, don't-take-away-my-right-to-kill-country and the fucked-up priorities we might have in lieu of, I don't know, letting kids go to school without fearing for their lives? Glorified G is a powerful mirror being held up to America. Got a gun? In fact, I got two. That's okay, because I love God. Always keep it loaded. Yikes. There's an undertone of in the lyrics of anger, but as pointed out, it's a little tongue-in-cheek as well. A hooky chorus that repeats over and over and has you singing along about guns and smiling. Oops. The only thing more tragic is how it's actually become a self-fulfilling prophecy of our society in the 30 plus years since.
All right. I'm with you, Lou. I skip this one almost every time. There's something about the cleanness of that snare drum. It's a little too pristine. I cannot stand the chorus, the backing vocals on it. It seems so out of character at this point in their career. It's too direct of a song as compared to a lot of their other ones. I don't mind what it's, you know, singing about. It's just, there's something about it that doesn't feel genuine to me. I could be wrong, but yeah, I definitely skip it every time.
It's also Pearl Jam trying to be REM.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely see that. All right. Song number five, Dissident. We'll be right back.
lost him there. Overnight, I wasn't so sure. She wanted him to stay. What to say, what to say? Soon she was down, soon he was low. At a quarter past, a holy note.
This is probably the pinnacle of the band playing totally in sync with each other. In my opinion, in this song, you can't remove any component of it and have the song be as successful as it is with everybody all together. It's just the sum is, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in this case. And the main hook, you know, the way that the guitar hook that the song starts with and is throughout is probably one of the most memorable hooks in their catalog guitar-wise. And this is another great example to me of how adept this band is at controlling dynamics. And when you have really quiet passages and louder passages, they're really masterful at that. And I do like how the song ends with that kind of semi-feeding back guitar note that just kind of takes it out. The song is almost perfect to me. And I've always loved it. And I always love the CD single, which had, I think, almost the entire show from the Fox Theater in Atlanta on it, too, which was great.
Wildly considered their best show of all time.
Alive, part two. Hooky guitar riff opens this up, and this album will not let up in a good way. A song about secretly taking in a refugee or a fugitive and trying to survive against the odds, which eventually catch up with the protagonist, and she has to turn the person in, leaving her with guilt. Pearl Jam lead vocalist Eddie Vedder said about the song Dissident, "In Dissident, I'm talking about a woman who takes in someone being sought after by authorities. He's on the run. She offers him refuge. She can't handle the responsibility. So she turns him in and has to live with the guilt and realization that she's betrayed the one thing that gave her life meaning." The song has dynamics, a little heavy subject matter. The verses are balanced and meaningful, each time leading back into a heavy chorus lines that have the lyricist and guitar player feeding off each other to keep elevating the song higher and higher. The break was forgettable, but the song rocks for being such a depressing story overall.
It's really songs like this that make me wonder why they call these guys grunge. This is almost a southern rock song, plain and simple. Instead of a traditional solo, we get a middle eight that gives us that release in the form of a key change that slides back into the verse. It's a very cool song, and you're right. No one part of the song, if you took it out, the song wouldn't work. This is them in perfect sync.
This is a classic Mike McCready song, if you ask me. He's playing with feel, and they're letting him do that more on this song than probably anything before that, except for maybe like that solo on Alive. But his bending of the notes, like you said, it's very southern rock or blues based. I could see Stevie Ray Vaughan playing the intro to this. I love how you have the heavy and then the light, the heavy and then the light with the sonics of it. The chorus is very catchy. Weird subject matter again. Like where did he think of this? You know, come up with either like an actual refugee or dissident or somebody that's just running from the law that's committed a crime. Pretty straightforward story, which you know, Eddie doesn't have a lot of those that are just not open for interpretation. But I'm with Ian. This one is the sum of the part. Everybody's contributing to it. I just love Mike's feel on this, and to me, that's what makes the song. Song number six, WMA. We'll be right back.
Okay. So far we've gotten political. Why not dive into racism and police profiling? According to Alan Jones' book, Pearl Jam, The Illustrated Story, WMA was inspired by an incident that happened outside the rehearsal studio in which Vedder got into an altercation with police officers who hassled a black friend of his but ignored him. For all the songs of the 90s that talked about F the police, this one kind of flew under the radar for me. Maybe because it more or less targeted a bad apple instead of the orchard in general, which I'm glad about. Musically, the song is underlaid with a constant guitar, bass, and percussion part that loop over and over again. There's another guitar layered over the top that sings a bit during the verses. It's almost as if MacReady and Vedder traded vocal and guitar part traditional roles. And it works. I hear something new every time I listen to this song. I wasn't ready for it 30 years ago, but I like it now.
This song is almost like tribal to me. I really, really, I didn't connect with this when it first came out because I was 12 years old at the time. And when you're 12 years old, you want to hear Animal and things like that, you know, just straightforward rock. But over the years, I've really come to love this track. Jeff's bass and Dave's drums together Dave's drums are like hypnotic on this, and Eddie's kind of chanting the vocal. It's over the top. It's really the icing on the cake to me. But this is one of those examples in the Pearl Jam catalog. This is not really a song. I mean, in the traditional definition of the word, but the band has a lot of songs like that in their catalog. Like the one that immediately comes to mind to me is Arc, where it's just kind of almost a thematic little piece that bridges portions of the album, but it just works. I always like the vibe on this song a lot.
That's exactly what I consider this song, as a bridge from Dissident to Blood. But let's give it up for Dave A again. He must have had a ball doing this, all those layers, driving Jeff's burbly, bubbly bass line. There's so many textures coming into play with the two guitars weaving their spell in each ear. And Ed moaning about racial injustice. It reminds me of Chipaway, actually, a Jane's Addiction song that's got the layered drum circle type drums. Jane's comes out in concert with Mike Igloos and the Igloo Coolers and beat on them. Pearl Jam does nothing of the sort. But this is still a great track. And they pull it out live every once in a while in concert. I've seen it. Good tune. Love it.
Can we say appetizer for No Code? This song, if you told me was on No Code, I like, oh, that's number 3 or 4 on No Code. Completely different from anything that they've done. Like you said, Dave A shines on this. This is his song. I do love how the band slowly comes in and is mixed a little higher as the song goes on. For the longest time, I had a hard time understanding Eddie's lyrics because it's a little bit of an echo or a fade on it, and it's set a little far back in the mix. Sean, you were talking about like the subject matter for Glorified G being, you know, prophetic. This is George Floyd, essentially, this song. And they seem to be ahead of the curve on a lot of stuff. If we're just being honest, in the 90s, the Ticketmaster thing, the gun control debate, the racial profiling that, you know, came to a head during COVID with the George Floyd issue. And I do remember somebody saying like, oh, I'm really glad that Taylor Swift's taking on Ticketmaster, and the meme had Eddie Vedder just doing this. We tried to do this 30 years ago. I'm like you guys, this is one that I couldn't appreciate when I was 16 years old, you know, when it came out. I find it one of the more interesting and satisfying songs in their catalog now. And I went back and watched some videos of them playing it with Matt Cameron. No offense to him, but he hasn't been able to repeat it the way Dave A did. I would be interested to know, was this one take of him on the drums, or do they have to cut a lot of different takes in? Because he keeps that crazy rhythm the entire song. And, you know, I just I think it's fascinating. I think it's one of the most original songs in their catalog, and to be honest with you, probably took some bravery to put that out in 1993. People didn't necessarily view the world as the way they do now. But that leads us to the next song, which is one of the angriest songs in the catalog, Blood.
Blood.
Well, here's the Angry Ed again. I remember starting to worry about him at this point. He just sounds unbalanced. Maybe he was. This was all too much for him to take. He thought he was joining a little punk outfit in Seattle and not this juggernaut that caught fire and rocketed them all into the stratosphere. Here's Pearl Jam bucking the system, newly led by Ed, whether they all knew it or not, he took over. And here they deliver the anti-Jeremy. It's the new anti-Alive. This is the furthest thing from a hit they could muster, and it sounds like they're having a cathartic moment in the process. More power to them. Again, live, this song has wings, and it's fun to collect the shows with it on the set list to hear the different interpretations of it and what songs come out of it and what it runs into and things. It's just another powerful tune. I feel sorry for his voice.
Lace up your Doc Martens and get ready to head to the mosh pit, posers. It's time to draw blood. Lyrics here seem to be Ed grappling with the demands of stardom and celebrity. Well, you came back to record the second album, so you're in it now, buddy. Just as Lou said, they really kind of stretched themselves with this one. Listen around the 36-second mark or a minute 22 in. You've got McCready doing some wah-wah funk guitar. This shouldn't be overlooked. I feel like he's expanding and trying something new on the spot, and it works. And I would love to hear this one live more. Just getting into the live shows now myself, and I feel like I got a lot of catching up to do. The song overall loses me after about 2 minutes, though. Now it's just a tantrum. I was never big on tantrums or mosh pits.
I'll be perfectly honest. I've never been much of a fan when Pearl Jam try to venture into the punk territory for whatever reason. I get that punk is a major influence on the band stylistically, and I do appreciate what Lou was saying about this being kind of a cathartic moment on the record and for them, and it's all very true. It's just, I don't know, it's always a fucking mess when they try to go, you know, get a little more gritty and punky. But I will say that on this, in the quieter sections, there's some wah guitar going on that I really, really like. I think it's very, very much a cool little flourish in otherwise a song that's just pummeling the shit out of you. So, but really, this is a song I've never really connected with and not a big favorite of mine.
In my younger days, I thought this song felt very forced. It was a forced anger, like almost like he had to reclaim his justification for some of his feelings after becoming really famous. Sean, I'm glad you hit on that. Hello, you did record number two. It's always been a big point of contention for me when I'm about to upset some people. So this is a hot take. You know, Kurt Cobain complained about being famous. You signed with Geffen Records, which was the biggest rock label at the time, and you made a follow-up album to one of the biggest albums of all time. And so you can't imagine if you're selling 10 million copies of an album, you're going to be ridiculously famous, and the press is going to want you. And in a time when there wasn't social media, your only way to really get publicity was to do radio interviews or magazine interviews, primarily for musicians. And there was going to be a lot of push and pull on that. As I've gotten older, I've appreciated it more and the sentiment behind it. Honestly, being in podcasting like Ian and I've done, we've been fortunate enough to talk to some people that have attained kind of this level of fame, and you understand the demands on people. And I can feel, I know he kind of felt like people were probably just taking his soul from him, but I have liked this song more and more the older I get. I agree. I don't know how his voice couldn't hold up to singing this every night, or the veins in his brain, because he is really straining on this. But this is classic angry Eddie Vedder, and I like angry Eddie Vedder. All right, the next song on the album is a classic, Rearview Mirror.
Sophie,
I think this is a great song about getting the hell out of a bad situation. I saw things clearer in the rearview mirror. It's actually, I didn't know this till more recently. It's one of the earlier songwriting entries for Eddie Vedder. He was the songwriter on this, and he contributes guitar for one of the first times on a record. And as much as Eddie Vedder tries to avoid this at all times, even a song with this emotional weight, it manages to come off catchy. He always sneaks a hook in there. He's really a master at hooky melodies and putting little earworms in there and things like that. I've always loved this song. It's a great one, especially live.
This song stood out as one of the favorites when I first heard the record, and still continues to wind up on any kind of Pearl Jam playlist or mixtape or CD or whatever I used to do. It's just a great song. This one, you said it before, it's got Ed on the main riff with Stone and Jeff providing the groove. And this picks up steam as the song progresses and begins to cannonball towards the end. Dave A is like a diesel engine with a busted throttle cable. By the end, he just crashes the whole fucking shenanigans into the wall, as you can hear him throw the sticks in frustration at the end of the track. It's an amazing track. It's usually a good set closer too. And it's a real powerful tune. And you're right, it's a great subject matter. Just let's get the fuck out of here. Leave a bad situation behind. Leave you in my rearview mirror.
I don't have much more to add. That's not going to stop me from talking anyway. This is about 161 beats per minute. I timed it out on my metronome because I'm a nerd like that. That's not easy to do if you're in a band. That's not easy to do in a live setting, let alone at the end of a show. Makes me appreciate Pearl Jam that much more. I go to this one first often when I pull this album up on digital, and it's a standard for me. I love it.
Whenever I watch a video of them playing this live, the way that Eddie plays it during the whole thing gives me anxiety. he is just wearing that top string out, just top couple of strings. This is one of those ones, like Lou said, if you see any kind of compilation album, this is going to be on it. Most people probably have this in their top 10. Lyrics, like you said, are pretty straightforward. Getting out of a bad situation, really a bad relationship, and you can sure see things a whole lot clearer when you're looking, you know, looking behind you. Like Ian said, it's got a lot of melody. One of the problems I've had with Eddie, though, over the years, sometimes he gets right up on the edge of melody and then he pulls back, almost seemingly on purpose, I think, when he could go a little bit bigger, like a little bit more anthemic. But this is one where he does not do that. And I love how he screams the title there toward the end, kind of like full realization that the problems are in the past. I mean, I don't know anybody that's a Pearl Jam fan doesn't like this song. So great tune. All right, we're going to move on to Rats.
They don't eat, don't sleep, they don't feed, they don't see. They're the gums when they moan and squeak, lick the dirt off a larger one's feet. They don't push, don't crowd, congregate until they're much too loud. Fuck to procreate till they are dead, drink the blood of this occult.
Now for something completely different, we get Rats. Who are the Rats? Who is Ben? What is going on? These guys have me, and just as quickly they lose me. It's my skipper. That's it. It's my review of the song.
I think this is a really cool, like, drum and bass kind of combo groove going on here. And only Eddie Vedder could kind of write a hooky song about rats, essentially. It's interesting. His gift for hook is unparalleled in a lot of ways. The verse vocal reminds me of something that I can't quite put my finger on, but it's oddly familiar to me, and I don't know. It's been driving me insane since we've been revisiting this record for this episode, because I can't figure out what it is. But again, also some more tasty wah guitar for the taking, which I always am a big fan of. So this is another one of those songs that when the record first came out, I kind of went by it, and it's only, you know, years down the road that I came to appreciate it a bit more. But I like it much more now than I ever did before.
This is my favorite tune on the record. Jeff's low end bass riff drives this like a distorted old porn movie. The low swing that this has, provided by Dave, gives a Stone Mike a chance to slither, while Ed compares us to rats and preferring the latter, complimenting the social structure and culture we can't match. They don't shit where they're not supposed to. Mike gives a funky solo and they crash back into the chorus. That key shift after the breakdown causes me to lose balance if I have headphones on, and the release that it causes makes my hair just stand on its end. Fuck Me Running. This is a great tune. And Ben, the two of us need love no more.
Ben, the two of us need love no more.
Oh, right now. I'd like to punch Brendan O'Brien for fading this out.
All right. I feel like this is
it sounded like dice.
Little Miss Muffet.
I feel like this is like 9 o'clock on a radio station I used to listen to during the week where they played Love It or Shove It. People either love this one or they hate this one. Apparently there is no Switzerland on it. I don't hate it, but I don't love it. So I guess I'm kind of in the middle. I do agree. The instrumentation on it is really cool. Them doing a little bit of slow funk there at the beginning, and the lyrics to me are a little dicey there. Not exactly my favorite. For a long time, like, I literally would skip this song like a minute in and kind of gave up on it because of kind of the intro. I'll be honest with you, I've really kind of listened to it all the way through pretty much this week for preparing for this, even though this is one of my favorite Pearl Jam albums. So I guess I'll be the deciding vote on this, and I'll shove it. Sorry, Lou. All right. So we'll go to song number 10, and I'll do a very, 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 very poor Eddie Vedder impression on this, because in one of my favorite bootlegs, he goes, "This is the longest song in the Pearl Jam catalog, Elderly Woman in a Small Hometown." Anyway, he kind of fades off. He said, "That was terrible." All right, so Elderly Woman Behind the Counter in a Small Town.
I seem to recognize your face. Haunting, familiar, yeah, I can't seem to place it. Cannot find the candle of thought to light your name. Lifetimes are catching up with me. All these changes take place. I wish I'd seen the place, but no one's ever taken me. Hearts and thoughts, they fade away. Hearts and thoughts, they fade away.
Longest title in the catalog.
It's the longest title in the catalog.
Another tour bus sounding song. Great sentiment. Man, I haven't seen you in years. You stayed the same and I changed. I left and you stayed here. He'd revisit this and off he goes, and on No Code. It sounds like Ed's working out some things and leaving his home and joining the circus. sounds like he was once a little fragile and the road hardened him up. The band gives him the perfect backdrop to spill his heart out and to his old girlfriend or buddy or whoever. And it's glimpses of greatness that keep me coming back to this guy, regardless of his pontificating douchebaggery. I love this guy's sentiment sometimes.
I can't imagine as a performer what it feels like to be standing in front of, you know, 15, 20,000 people. And when you do the "I just want to scream hello" lyric, they're all singing it back at you. This is like one of their biggest anthems for that reason to me. And it's funny that a song that's so melancholy and such a almost a sad undertone to the lyrics to it can have that effect on people, that they still will sing it as if it's like some kind of anthem. But I don't know. Eddie Vedder just has a way of communicating that melancholy very well in songs, like particularly in this one, just the simple line, "Hearts and thoughts, they fade away." It's just so powerful. Like, this is Eddie Vedder at a lyrical and vocal peak, as far as I'm concerned. And there's also a stripped down acoustic version of this that was on a single. And that really manages to work, even just with all the parts removed and just kind of Eddie and the guitar. But I think it's at its most anthemic in this setting and really the way it works best.
Well, 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 these punky little grunge bitches from Seattle got themselves into a little Bob Dylan. Who do these guys think that they are? Oh, wait a minute. This is good. This song's really good. Rightfully so, it has become an anthem, Ian, when played at their live show. Sing this with the band and 20,000 of your closest friends the next time you see these guys, and I don't care who you are, this will get you. This sets Pearl Jam on another level with songwriting and compositions.
It's my favorite song in the Pearl Jam catalog. It's a campfire sing-along that's not exactly happy. So I grew up in a very, very, very small town. When Ian came to visit me here, I took him there. It's pretty small, isn't it, Ian?
Certainly is.
Very small. And I was one of the people that got out. I have literally lived this story where people that you were really close with growing up and you go back home for something. My dad still owns a business there. I'll go there. And I'll see people that maybe I grew up riding bikes with, and I almost don't even recognize them. Or people that I thought were really, really cool in high school when I was growing up, and their life decisions have left them in a really bad place. And here I am just kind of passing through. Hey, how are you doing? Remember me? How are you doing? I'm out. And this song has always hit home to me. It's very personal to me. I agree with Ian. The acoustic version of this is great. A lot of times when they play it live, it's just Eddie singing it and playing it. But I'm like you, Ian, he has a talent for making 20,000 people sing along to something that's not happy. And that's an amazing thing. It's kind of like live, you know. He said now that people have kind of turned it around to, it is a positive song, like taking from it, hey, I beat the odds and I'm good, versus, you know, what it was really about. But I was telling Lou beforehand, there's two bands on my bucket list I haven't seen. It's Pearl Jam and Aerosmith. And when I do go see Pearl Jam, if they don't play this, I'm going to be upset, because like I said, it really hits home for me. I've lived it, and I know that feeling of when you go home and you feel sorry for some people, and then you're like, I'm glad I made the choices I did. And I've seen many a good people go down the wayward path because they didn't get out. So anyway, enough getting mushy about that, but that is my favorite song in the Pearl Jam catalog. And that leads us to another angry song, Angry Eddie here, and that's song number 11, Leash.
Home within
I think this track has a super catchy chorus to it. The verses sound a little thrown together to me, which is a shame because the band is really on fire here. It's not one of my top tracks on the record, but I think it overall fits into the big picture of the record as a whole. And, you know, kind of needs to be where it is. And it's, that's one thing I never actually touched on so far is, I'm really big on sequencing of albums, and this album is really nicely sequenced. And I think where Leash falls in the track sequence, it makes perfect sense.
The penultimate track. This is the first song that I heard off of this album on a bootleg live tape from the first tour that gave a glimpse of what was coming on the record. And it sounded a bit more punk rock in its early form, too, than it does here, if you can believe that. You could hear the frustration and disillusionment in the attitude of the way he delivers it. Drop the leash. Get out of my fucking face. He didn't want to be molded like the rest of the crop. He wanted to do it with integrity. He doesn't want to be his parents or your parents or his school teachers or what authority wants them to be. And he screams delight in our youth. He let him be young, live life the way he wants. And it's a powerful tune. Good tune.
Even Flow Part 2. Well, at least at the beginning. Troubled souls unite. I am lost. I'm no guide, but I am by your side. If I didn't know any better, and I don't know the timeline, it's apparent that I often don't know any better. I believe this might be a response to the controversy of Eddie being on the cover of Time and perhaps the conflict it put between him and Kurt Cobain, or between him and his own band, or between him and his peers in the industry. I feel like it's Eddie saying, hey, believe what you want to, but I know what I stand for and who I am. Lou, to your point earlier, what he actually does with that power later on, debatable. Really like the song, though.
I'll keep it short and sweet. This is Pearl Jam doing The Who's My Generation. All right. The last track on the album is Indifference.
Till it burns up my arm. Oh, I'll keep taking punches until their will grows tired. Oh, I won't stare the sun down until my eyes go blind. Hey, I won't change direction, and I won't change my mind. How much difference does it make? How much difference does it make?
I think this is almost a continuation or a coda to Leash. What does it matter to you if I apologize or don't for what I've done? Will it matter? Will we have a real conversation, or do you just have your image of me pretty much set in stone and it doesn't matter what I say? I'll hold the candle until it burns up my arm. I'll keep taking punches until their arms grow tired. I will stare the sun down until my eyes go blind. I won't change direction and I won't change my mind. And then later, I will scream my lungs out until it fills this room. But how much difference will it make? Is he talking about himself or his detractors or both? They closed out this record with a bit of a thinker, almost like ending a concept album.
Believe it or not, they open shows with this. They do a one or two slow tunes to open, let everybody get to their seats, and then they whack you in the teeth with a rocker once that everyone's settled. They're very conscious about set list and song order that live, but this is the perfect album closer. Contemplative Ed is way better than Angry Ed for me. And this song is the closest thing you'll feel to the church when you're standing in section 107 at Madison Square Garden and the place is lit up with lighters and the whole fucking crowd is singing back at Ed at full lung capacity, arms aloft, palms held skyward. Brings a tear to my eye every time. It makes a lot of difference, Ed. That's how much.
Sometimes it really works to finish an album on a wind down note, and sometimes it doesn't. In the case of Verse, I think it's fitting to kind of simmer on out. The listener, except for a few quiet moments here and there, has been sonically and emotionally pummeled on this journey, and it's nice to take a breath and kind of reflect on the way out. This is probably one of the more atmospheric tracks in the band's catalog, and I wholeheartedly agree with Lou that this is really a perfect album closer.
All right. Anybody who's listened to any of our other podcasts knows David loves a mellow tune to send out an album. And this is just a great tune. I believe it was on the Live at the Garden DVD. Is that right, Lou, when Ben Harper came out? You know, and Vetter goes, Ben Harper.
I was sitting in the room when that happened.
So, I mean, that's one of my favorite live DVDs of all time. Anyway, I'm not going to get back on that. This is a 2 o'clock in the morning, last song before you go to bed. Tune, ease you out before you call it a night. Like you said, introspective Ed is great. This is some of his better lyrics. The delivery on it's perfect. Brendan O'Brien showed so much constraint with this on the production and the instrumentation. And like you said, this is one of, it's probably possibly their best album closer and one of the better, more mellow tunes in their catalog. And I was telling y'all beforehand, I'm a big fan of mellow Pearl Jam. So, great way to end a great album. All right. Now that we're through with our track by track analysis, we'll give the record our final thoughts with a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being a favorite of ours, down to a 0 or the woman that's left behind at the counter in a small town.
This record was like listening to a new band. It had nothing to do with the last record, which now sounds like a different band. This was Mirror Universe Pearl Jam, where they weren't as polished, way angrier, and a bit singed on the end bits. Ed's been around the world. He's seen a few things, and he's learned not to be so open about his life and is learning to push back and do things he had always envisioned. At the start, this was Jeff and Stone's band, but you can hear the switch. You can hear where Ed takes over, and this becomes his band. And there'd be another lineup change in the future that would cement his reign as leader. But this is the first step in the Pearl Jam becoming his band. I give Verses a 4. It's got some of the best songs the band does, and most are still live staples. It's not as accessible as 10 and not as frustrating as some of the later records, but it's still not their best work, but it's a damn good album.
I'm almost 100% in agreement with Lou's sentiment there. This, for me as a kid, 10 was the more accessible record because as a kid, your palate's a little more simple and you kind of go for the straightforward stuff. But as the years have gone on, I've really, really grown to, this has climbed the ladder in terms of where I place their albums in terms of my personal like of them. And I would give this album a solid 4.
Well, throughout my quips tonight, I've alluded to Verses being more or less a continuation of the band's debut, 10. And in ways it is, but in many more ways, it even transcends its predecessor. And that's fucking saying something. I'm a huge fan of early Pearl Jam, in large part due to this album. I think it accurately reflects where Eddie and the fellas were with life after experiencing the whirlwind success of their debut. And the storied past of the group even before then, even before Ed. It's easy for a band to lose the plot around albums 2 or 3, but with Verses, Pearl Jam seemed to just be settling in. At the time, I remember thinking, these guys probably don't have but 1 or 2 more albums in them. There's no way they can sustain this. Thankfully, I've been very wrong about that. Verses is a gem, an informed, well-placed, well-thought-out, but not overdone gem. I hear something new every time I sit down with it. My friend Jesse's a longtime 10 Club member and probably one of the biggest Pearl Jam fans, and he summed it up pretty good. He said, Dave's A drumming on this record makes me want to be a better person and give it my rating. This album could have easily been forgotten in between 10 and Vitalogy, but it shouldn't be. None of the albums since would have been a good had they not laid this one down. There are very, very few bands whose record I'll ever give above a 4 rating for, and this is one of them. Verses is a solid 4.
Sophomore slump? I don't think so. This is a band realizing how good they are. They've been road tested, battle tested. They have exceeded expectations from when they were signed as a band. They've seen the world, and they were tasked with coming up with a sequel to one of the defining albums of our generation, and they knocked it out of the park. Completely different than 10, the band's sound would continue to evolve with Vitalogy and then take a real left turn with No Code. But this is a band realizing who they are, firing on all cylinders. I give it a solid 4. All right. For the R4 podcast, I'm David.
I'm Lou Figaro.
The long-winded but informative Sean Hillman.
And I'm Ian Rice.
See ya. The Ridiculous Rock Records Review podcast is hosted by Jason Donsis, David Hudson, Sean Hillman, and Ian Rice. Show produced and directed by Jason Donsis. Logo by David Hall. Theme music from the Steepwater Band. Find them online at steepwater.com. If you have questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for the show, or just want to connect, find us on your favorite social media platform at R4Podcaster, or email us at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com. The R4 Podcast was created by Aaron Martell. Thank you for dropping the needle with us. Until next time, rock on.
Jesus Christ, David.
I'm going to be honest with you, man. This format stresses me out. I'm going to be honest.
I know. You're like, you're like a nervous Snelly over there all the time. Focus.
I hope we release the video with this where you pointed at us.
All right.
And we all looked at you like, huh?
I'm going to count us in, and we are out.
No, it's see ya.
See ya.
He crashed out.